from the JAMA Network. This is the JAMA Pediatrics Editor Summary, a discussion of the most important articles published in the latest issue of JAMA Pediatrics. Here are your hosts, Frederick Rivara and Dimitri Christakis.
Hello, podcast listeners. This is Dimitri Christakis coming to you from the Husky Lounge at Seattle Children's Research Institute. With me, as always, is my friend, mentor, colleague, and sidekick, Dr. Fred Rivara, editor-in-chief of JAMA Network Open. Hi, Fred.
The best open access journal in the world.
The best open access journal in the world. You'll be listening to this in July. It's May here in Seattle, and it's 85 degrees out there. It feels like it's July. So
God knows what's going to be in July when people are listening to this thing.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, all right. So we got two interesting papers today that we'll try to put in perspective for you. Fred, you want to go first? This one actually relies fairly heavily on kind of the seminal work that you've done in the past. So
well,
let's hear it.
This article is on looking at household firearm storage, safe storage of firearms. And, you know, every week here we're recording this in mid-May, and there have been two school shootings in the last couple of weeks. We don't know yet where the individuals obtained their guns. But we do know that suicide is increasing in the United States among kids as well as adults, and that about half the suicides in the United States are due to firearms.
We also know a shocking statistic that I recently came across in the New York Times, which is that more four-year-olds and more kids under the age of four die each year in the United States by firearms than police in the line of duty.
Right, and those are the accidental ones, which are due to mishandling of guns by various people in the household. And so this is a serious problem, and I think it's particularly appropriate for pediatricians because the key is really safe storage of firearms. And so this is a study which combines data from two different prior reports and trying to look at if we had more people safely store their firearms, how many suicides in the United States among youth and unintentional injury deaths among youth could be prevented. So it's based upon two prior studies. One is a very nice study published in JAMA many years ago by my colleague David Grossman, who did a case control study looking at the effectiveness of safe storage of firearms on suicide, unintentional injury deaths in kids. And what he found is that the safe storage of firearms can prevent on the order of about 70% or so of those kinds of injuries, the suicides and the unintentional injuries among youth. It's really the only case control study, the only good study we have on how effective is safe storage of firearms. And then the other study that these folks are building upon is a study done by one of the authors of this current report, Matt Miller, who's at Northeastern University, collaborates with the folks at Harvard, where they did a survey of people across the United States to find out about gun ownership, but also about safe storage of firearms. And so they combine those two pieces of information to try to look at how much can these firearm deaths be prevented in children. So to start off with, I think it's important to know what's the baseline. What are we starting off with here? And, you know, the issue here is that there are a lot of kids in the United States living in homes with guns, and a lot of those guns are not safely stored. And in fact, that about a third of kids in the United States live in households that have firearms.
Right.
And among those households that have firearms, about half of those are not safely stored.
So that alone speaks volumes.
That speaks volumes, really does. And so, you know, if what these folks do is try to do a kind of a paper and pencil computer model, if we could get those people to safely store their firearms, how many deaths could we save? And what they show, depending upon the likelihood of being able to get people to safely store their firearms, we could save a lot of lives. I mean, in fact, we can save on the order of 200 to 300 lives a year in the United States from firearms. Now, that's a lot. We're in the midst of a measles epidemic, as all our listeners know. I don't think there are any children who have died yet from measles. Likely that will occur. But nevertheless, it will be a rare occurrence. But here, where we have deaths occurring to children all the time, and by implementing safe storage, we can save 200 to 300 lives of kids each year in the United States is really pretty remarkable.
Right, and that's the point estimate. And they did a sensitivity analysis around it, and it was robust to that. And it could be more, it could be fewer. But as you said, every life saved in a kid that age. And this is, and I think it's important to note, this is not a Second Amendment issue. This is not taking away guns.
No.
This is not.
And most, you know, even more background checks.
And
you talk to all sensible gun owners, and they all agree that firearms should be stored safely. And I think the message here for pediatricians, our listeners, is that you should be asking families, is there a firearm in the home? And if there is, don't talk with them about getting rid of the gun. Talk with them about, is it safely stored? Can your children or adolescents obtain access to it? Do they know where the key is? Do they know the combination? And if not, help them to figure out how to safely store that firearm. That's really the bottom line, is if firearms in a home, we need to make sure that they're safely stored.
Well, I think that's the bottom line on the ground for our clinician listeners. But we also wear hats as advocates and as voters. And the fact that this is not more of an issue on the campaign trail, which in theory should be indisputed, right? This should be a bipartisan issue. We hear about gun control, which I'm in favor of, background checks, which most people are in favor of. We can't get any traction on those. So one might say we wouldn't get traction on this either. But
well, there are laws, and there's called the CAP laws, the Child Access Prevention laws, and they exist in a lot of states, and they exist in various flavors. And one of the issues is that unless the law has a felony penalty to it, it's not going to be terribly effective. But if it does have a stricter penalty with it, it is effective. And Sherry Barkin a number of years ago showed that pediatricians counseling families about firearms can increase safe storage of firearms. So there are things that we can do both in our offices as well as advocates in the community to really decrease the toll of firearms on our kids' lives and the lives of our community.
All right. Thank you, Fred. The next paper we have is called The Association of Parent Training with Child Language Development, A Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. So there's a really very good literature showing that language development is incredibly important in terms of predicting children's long-term success. In fact, probably not known to many of you, is that the single best predictor of success in school is third grade reading. In fact, third grade reading predicts success in math at graduation, as well as obviously success in language and arts, better than anything else.
And you say third grade reading, is it that kids are grade level at reading?
The kids that are grade, if you're not at grade level at third grade, correct, you have much worse outcomes. It's not entirely surprising because obviously reading is kind of foundational for all learning in schools. So language development is clearly very important. And we also know that as many as 12% of children between the ages of 2 and 5 have some amount of developmental delay in language. It's much more common, as many as 50% in low-income families. And in fact, when you put all this together, what you see is that that in children 2 to 5 years of age, the problems with language development are nearly twice the rate of childhood obesity.
And really?
We spent a lot of time in this room talking about childhood obesity.
And there's not much we can do about it, frankly.
Well, and in fact, we've spent a lot of time reviewing studies that are negative or ineffective.
Right.
And so the interesting thing here, and I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, is that, or we're getting ahead of ourselves, is that this is something we can do something about, or at least we may be able to do something about. So they basically tried to do a meta-analysis to pull together everything that's been done or tried to try to improve the language environment of home, specifically targeting parents. We know that getting parents to interact with their kids more is vitally important to their language development. So they did a systematic review and meta-analysis. And, you know, it's been a long time, Fred. I don't know when the last time you did a systematic review or meta-analysis. I did some during my fellowship and early faculty career. And I think with, you know, we talk about big data, and it's gotten really big here, too. I mean, so they were 32,000 unique records that they identified, and they reviewed the full text of 723 articles, itself a major undertaking, and ultimately identified 76 studies that they included. And they looked at...
Were these randomized trials?
They were a combination of randomized controlled trials and observational studies, and they analyzed the data both ways. And they looked at four different domains, but I'll focus on two of them. The first is, what is the association between training parents and getting parents to actually do evidence-based language support strategies at home? And then more importantly, what is the association between the parent training and actual language and communication outcomes in children? And basically, in both cases, the effects, well, actually, in the case of parents, the effect size is 0.55, which is actually a large size. It's a pretty large size, which is to say that training parents is highly likely to get them to do what they're supposed to do in order to promote language. And then, of course, more important is the child outcomes themselves, and there the effect size is 0.33, which is in the kind of moderate range. So the bottom line is that there are effective strategies that parents can be trained to do and that actually work. And apropos what we were discussing before, given the prevalence of the problem, the importance of the problem, the fact that there are existing effective strategies, the question is begged, why isn't this getting more attention? Now, I should point out, for those of you listening who are clinicians, these aren't things that you do in your office as a pediatrician. Although I would argue, because of my own passion on this topic, that you should emphasize how important talking to your kids is. I sort of feel like language should be the fifth vital sign. Now that we've gotten rid of pain as a fifth right. vital sign, we can add something else. So now language can be the fifth vital sign. I think you should emphasize how important it is.
So what should parents be doing, though?
Well, it's a really good question. So
is it reach out and read, or what is it?
Well, so reach out and read is something that pediatricians can do in their office, which has been shown to be effective. It's one of the interventions that's been shown. But more than even reading, it's the idea of what we call kind of dialogic reading or serve and return, which is to get parents to interact with their kids. So dialogic reading, for those of you that don't know, is kind of the science of how to read to young children. And in full disclosure, before I got interested in child development, which is when I had kids, I didn't know about this stuff and I didn't do it. I read the exactly wrong way, which is actually how most educated
just
people
reading
do.
The book.
You read the book. That's kind of like level one wrong. Right. You read the book with, which is better than not reading.
But, right.
And then level two reading is kind of asking the child questions that are simple for them to answer and that don't require a lot of thought. And I did a fair amount of this too. So where is the bear?
Right.
Where is the dog? Where they can essentially just point
right.
reflexively without. And level three, which is dialogic reading, is actually to ask the child open-ended questions that require them not only to provide a verbal answer, but to actually, before they're able to provide a verbal answer, to start to formulate pre-verbal, to lay the foundation for pre-verbal thought. So not so much where is the bear, but what is the bear going to do? What is the bear thinking? To really get them to need to rely on language
right.
rather than just pointing. It starts creating all those prompts. So those are the kinds of interactions that need to be promoted. I think the holy grail here, though, is really to find kind of scalable interventions that
right.
are that really can reach diverse low-income populations that don't require kind of aggressive parent training. And we have a pilot study coming out in JAMA Network Open. We just was just accepted
right.
trying to do clinic-based interventions that rely on, in our case, using a commercially available app to push out strategies to parents in their homes in real time to get them to have those kinds of interactions. So stay tuned to see whether or not that is borne out in larger studies. But in the meantime, I think in your offices, emphasizing the importance of teaching of language environment, having a reach out and read program if you don't already have one, and finding and referring interested parents to existing programs that they could participate in.
And I think, you know, what our listeners need to know is that even if you have a child who had, say, like it was a premature infant and had a intracranial hemorrhage, that by this kind of intensive interaction with parents and child development work, you can basically make up for that brain injury. And the outcomes...
Certainly mitigate it.
Mitigate
yes.
it.
Yes.
And the outcomes can be very good.
Absolutely.
And the problem that, as we all know, is that you have less educated parents that are have a lot of chaos in their households. They're at greatest risk of having children that have biological problems, but also they have problems with the parenting.
Right.
So those are the kids that are sort of the double whammy.
Well, double, triple, quadruple. How many
right.
additional hits do we
right.
want to put on them? But you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And interestingly, I think particularly for there, you often have parents who themselves For whom literacy is not very normative.
Right.
They're not comfortable reading. They're certainly not something they do for pleasure. And I think that's where it's also really important to emphasize that there are other ways that they can enrich the language environment for kids. So we did a study years ago at our low-income teaching clinic here where we basically did kind of a reach out and play instead of a reach out and read, and we gave parents blocks, these
right.
big Duplos, and basically encouraged them to play with the kids with blocks.
And talk with them.
Well, and in the process of it, talking with them, right? We gave them blocktivities, which said, you know, talk about the blocks, sort the blocks, count the blocks, build something with the blocks, and exactly. So it doesn't have to be books. It can be anything. It's just promoting talking with your children. All right.
I mean, it's... You know, both of the things we talked about today are things that pediatricians can do in their offices without spending a lot of time and money.
And we are mindful of how overburdened you
right.
all are, because neither of us live in that world. All right. Thank you all very much. Thanks for listening. Please tell all your friends to subscribe, and we'll see you next month. Bye-bye.